The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated July 4/July 11, 2022. The typically red border around the front cover is indented with a narrow white margin. Time, in large block letters, capital letters, is superimposed upon a whitish-gray background that features a huge surfer's wave, except it's a sculpture on a platform being photographed in a desert. Made of plastic and cardboard and other polypropylene materials, it looks like a gigantic wave, because this issue has some articles about the oceans, and I shall read at least one of them to you. Beginning then with the View Inbox, Space-Time, by Jeffrey Kluger, editor at large. NASA has spent more than 60 years flying UFOs. Every spacecraft that ever ventured out into the solar system would be a decidedly unidentified flying object to any alien intelligence that might encounter it. UFOs, or UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena, as they are more decorously called today, have been in the news frequently lately. In May, a House Intelligence Subcommittee conducted public hearings on more than 140 sightings by military pilots over the past 20 years of UAPs flying in all manner of inexplicable ways, bobbing, weaving, hovering, changing direction with head-snapping speed that would produce G-forces potentially deadly to any living being, or at least any living human being, inside. The congressional hearing followed the release last year of a Department of Defense study of UAPs, and both Congress and the Pentagon came to the same conclusion, which was basically, beats me. The objects could be natural phenomena misinterpreted by the pilots and their equipment. They could be new technology developed by a high-tech power like China. And yes, they could, in theory at least, be extraterrestrial. Now there is a third government agency getting involved in the effort to explain UAPs, NASA itself. As the space agency announced in June, NASA is launching its own investigation, beginning in the fall, to get to the bottom of the UAP mystery. The effort will be led by astrophysicist David Spergel, former chair of the Astrophysics Department at Princeton University. The study will analyze all available video data and first-hand accounts amassed so far, and consult both military and civilian experts for their analysis of the evidence. NASA is open to any and all interpretations of the data, though it is setting a high bar for at least one. There is no evidence, NASA said in a press release, that UAPs are extraterrestrial in origin. But absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, and NASA officials acknowledge anything is possible and say they will follow the findings wherever they might point. The tools of scientific discovery are powerful and apply here also, Associate Administrator Thomas Zurbuchen said in a statement. We have the tools and team who can help us improve our understanding of the unknown. That is the very definition of what science is. That is what we do. That is indeed what NASA does, and it's high time it brought those skills to the UAP mystery. After 6 decades of building and flying machines, it can very much explain. The space agency will at last turn its eyes to the one the world cannot. Language. This is by Sydney Hurston Dupree, assistant professor of organizational behavior at Yale. How stereotypes shape our words. From the first instant our eyes alight on a TV or phone screen, we are inundated with a curated set of images that supposedly depict the world around us. These images often show people of color through a stereotypical lens, and these stereotypes bleed into our everyday lives. Across dozens of studies featuring thousands of participants, I have found stereotypes leak into conversations even when we try to avoid them. In one test, I predicted white Americans who want to connect across racial divides, white liberals, would use language that attempted to reverse the stereotype that they are more competent than black and Latina people. I asked over 2,000 white Americans to introduce themselves to a black or white person online. As predicted, liberals used fewer words related to competence, like competitive or powerful, in their introductions when speaking to a black person. This complete competence downshift is not limited to a lab. I analyzed over 20 years of campaign speeches and found that white Democrats used fewer such words when addressing mostly minority audiences versus mostly white ones. But this behavior may backfire. My colleagues and I are now testing whether white liberals who use less competent language are seen as patronizing by black observers. Stereotypes force us into boxes, and we try to break free of them by using the most primary tool available to us, our words. Yet until we enact large-scale cultural changes that challenge these stereotypes, we will all continue to be shackled by them. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, Emmanuel Macron's Uncertain Path. Emmanuel Macron has had quite a ride the past few weeks. In April, he scored a resounding 17-point victory over far-right opposition veteran Marine Le Pen to secure a second 5-year term as France's president. Then, June 19, his political alliance suffered a historic defeat in parliamentary elections. His bloc needed 289 seats for a majority in the National Assembly, with just 245 seats, his ensemble alliance did not come close. It's the first time since 1988 that France's elections have not provided the winning party a majority of seats. Even in that case, François Mitterrand's socialists came close enough that his government could cobble together support for key pieces of legislation from a few opposition lawmakers on a case-by-case basis. That avenue will be much more difficult for Macron, with even more lawmakers to convince. Never mind, detailed negotiation and compromise have never been strong suits for a president who has not had much to do, or who has not had to do much horse trading during his political life. In short, Macron was elected to lead, but voters have not given him enough deputies to follow. France now enters a time of political uncertainty. It is not just that Macron will face intense opposition within the assembly from both left and right. Even the opposition blocs may break into pieces. The largest opposition alliance is composed of odd political bedfellows from the left who were brought together during the campaign by political firebrand Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who will want to keep this loose grouping of Greens, Socialists, Communists, and others, which won 131 seats in June, as part of a stable voting bloc. But the interests of these parties look too diverse for that. Macron is expected to look for limited backing from the conservative Les Républicains, LR, which will hold 64 seats in the Assembly. But the LR has its divisions, too. There are enough centrists in that party who share Macron's views on lowering taxes and state spending to provide backing for his reform agenda. But a sizable share of LR deputies now lean further toward the nationalist right. And many in this faction are eager to defy Macron's pro-EU, pro-business reform ideas. The LR's acting leader, Christian Jacob, has ruled out any plan to join with Ensemble in a formal coalition. Instead, he promises constructive opposition. The LR will choose a new leader this fall. And to avoid losing more members and voters to Le Pen's far-right, EU-hostile national rally, there is a good chance the new leader will steer the party further to the right. France's government will not be completely paralyzed. In a time of economic hardship, many will back new spending to help voters weather the economic storm by extending state subsidies to keep prices in check for electricity and fuel. And though the hard left and the far right will voice hostility toward sanctions on Russia and military support for Ukraine, there are enough deputies among centrists and Greens to continue support for Macron's plans. But the long-term reform agenda meant to make France more economically competitive will be nearly impossible to pass. Macron can only hope that several months of bitter political infighting will exhaust French voters, and that by next spring he can dissolve the Assembly and call new elections. But for now, it is hard to imagine what might change in the months ahead to incline voters towards strengthening Macron's hand. Waves of Change, a special report. Our oceans are growing ever more unstable thanks to the climate disruptions we have caused, but they also offer solutions that humanity cannot afford to ignore, by Elijah Wolfson. And here is a page and a quarter photograph, again, of that giant surf wave that's really plastic, a photograph of a tabletop sculpture. Rainforests may be known as the planet's lungs, but it's when standing before the seas with their crashing waves and ceaselessly cycling tides that we feel the earth breathe. The ocean, says scientists, is the source of all life on Earth. It is also, say philosophers, the embodiment of life's greatest terror, the unknown and uncontrollable. This duality has become increasingly manifest in the climate discourse of recent years. As ice melts, seas rise, and shores everywhere face storms of a ferocity unseen in living memory. But even as the ocean has become the subject of hand-wringing over what we have wrought, it has also become a keystone of hope that we may limit the damage if we act now. First, the bad news. But before that, I'll read the caption for that black and white page and a quarter photograph. It is the photo of a sculpture crafted out of recycled materials. It's Hugh Kretschmer's Plastic Waves. First, the bad news. While the front lines of climate change are emerging all around the globe, the first major wounds of global warming occurred in the low-lying island nations of the South Pacific, where communities have always lived and died by the sea and its bounty. For years now, there's been far more dying as they've been ravaged by climate change-related storms and flooding. When these countries have implored larger and wealthier and more culpable countries to do something, they have mostly been met with silence. Indeed, at a recent summit in Bonn, Germany, delegates from wealthy nations refused to support an effort to make sure discussion about compensating poorer countries for climate change damages would be on the agenda for COP27, the UN climate conference set to be held this November in Egypt. But it won't be long before these powerful nations are facing the sea's wrath too. The US, UK, Germany, Brazil, China, India, Japan, Indonesia are all among the countries with large populations living on land likely to be below sea level by 2100. Other escalating tragedies are at hand beneath the waters that make up over 70% of Earth's surface, from coral mass bleaching events to the destruction of marine biodiversity. There's no going back. But to keep the damage to these already awful levels and to even daydream of meeting the target the world theoretically agreed on in Paris back in 2015, we will have to find some way to work with and not against the sea. As Jane Lubchenco, marine ecologist and former head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration under President Obama, told my colleague Aaron Baker a couple of years ago, it is time to stop thinking of the ocean as a victim of climate change and start thinking of it as a powerful part of the solution. We can start at the bottom. The floor of the Pacific is littered with the rare metals we need to build the batteries necessary to power carbon-free travel. Moving upward by harnessing the force of the tides, we could plug another source of renewable energy into our struggling grids. Offshore wind farms are also poised to expand exponentially as an essential power source. And while we may think of road vehicles as the focus of electric mobility efforts, decarbonizing maritime shipping may be what really brings the global economy into a green future. Meanwhile, oceans are the central banks of Earth's carbon stocks. Researchers are hard at work figuring out how to affordably capture CO2 from fossil fuel burning plants and inject the gas into the rock below the ocean floor. And efforts are already underway to protect and rebuild oceanic ecosystems like mangroves, salt marshes, and seagrasses that not only sequester more CO2 than their land-bound counterparts, but also act as natural breakwaters to protect coastal populations. In an interview published in 2002, Werner Herzog, the filmmaker and intrepid philosopher of humanity's relationship with the natural world, raised the idea that civilization is like a thin layer of ice upon a deep ocean of chaos and darkness. At this moment, with record summer heat highs and record sea ice lows, Herzog's metaphor might be taken literally. Life as we know it, after all, exists only so long as the ice does not melt and the potential chaos of the oceans is not fully unleashed. But it's also worth considering something Herzog said nearly a decade and a half later. Speaking about his documentary Into the Inferno, he noted, "We face the climate problems. We do not because nature is angry, but rather because we're stupid." He continued, "We're not doing the right thing with our planet. If we did the right thing with our oceans, however, maybe their terrifying powers could save us." This was written by Elijah Wolfson with reporting by Simone Shaw. Time Off section features Elvis Has Not Left the Building by Stephanie Zakarik. Almost half a century after his death, a new movie shows the King's legacy has only gotten murkier. In 2022, there's no one Elvis Presley. The one true Elvis is actually many Elvises, a deity with an infinite number of faces, refracted into an ever-shifting pattern of pleasure and frustration, of contradictions and delights. For every Elvis myth, there's a counter-truth, and for every truth, a counter-myth. He will never be resolved or agreed upon. Which means that whether you love or loathe the movies of Baz Luhrmann, a kind of bedazzler kit in filmmaker form, it is easy to understand why he would be attracted to the legend of Elvis Presley. The movie he has made, Elvis, is both aggravating and fulfilling, a surface of sequined artificiality that reflects stark truths about our American pauper king with a cloth of gold voice. In a world where we want to believe we can close every mystery, Elvis, on and off the movie screen, continues to confound. There was a beginning to Elvis, the survivor of a set of twins, born to Gladys Presley, January 8, 1935. But even now, 45 years after his death, there is still no ending. There will always be tension in the very idea of Elvis, who grew up poor in Memphis and ended up richer than he could have imagined. He makes some people angry and others deliriously happy. His life and career are woven into America's ideas of race and class, but he also cuts across the grain of that fabric in jagged, unsettling strokes. Even if Elvis is forever, when Luhrmann first announced he was making an Elvis movie, back in 2014, the question might have been, why now? But in 2022, especially now that we've seen how politically, racially, and culturally fractured our nation could become, the many faces of Elvis form a sun mosaic that raises more questions than it answers. To look directly into its light is to see into ourselves, for better or worse. Was Elvis merely inspired by black artists, or did he steal from them outright? Was he a sexual abuser, first grooming an underage Priscilla Beaulieu? She was just 14 when the two met in 1959. And then, after marriage, subjecting her to any number of weird sexual proclivities? And who still cares about Elvis anyway? At the time of his death in 1997, he was a phenomenon who still had his fans, but one who was also drug-riddled, fat, and sad. For a time, he was more punchline than legend, and genteel Southerners in particular often thought of him as a gold-plated hick, gauche and offensive in his very being. In the 1990s, when I was living in Boston, a co-worker of mine who had grown up in Tennessee was appalled when she learned of my love for him. "He's the reason," she told me, "people from the North think Southerners eat dirt." You would think that by now older people would be tired of talking about Elvis, and that younger people don't care about him at all, but the truth isn't so easy to parse. Now that Elvis is back in the spotlight, some have taken to TikTok and Twitter to build angry but precarious cases against him for his treatment of Priscilla, who became his wife in 1967, defining her as a victim of abuse, even though she has not claimed that status for herself. She has admitted her union with Elvis was complicated. How could it not be? Yet even today there is a need to make Elvis manageable, less dangerous to our sense of order. He feeds into our modern need, fueled in part by reckonings that were a long time coming, to reduce people to something we can control, even if controlling the past is impossible. Elsewhere on TikTok, 26-year-old Elvis Roberts, an uncanny Australian Elvis lookalike, holds sway over 865,000 followers with his swoony bedroom eyes and cultivated half-sneer. If older Elvis impersonators tend to favor the jumpsuit-era Elvis as they age, the costume is forgiving of expanding girth. The dream of the young Elvis, as embodied by people like Roberts, coexists with the tragic, beautiful wreck he became. In this sense, his only true cultural twin is Marilyn Monroe, a star whose beauty, vulnerability, and sly intelligence made her so magnetic in life that we still hold her close long after her death, and whose story will be told in a movie due this fall, Blonde, an attempt to explore her complicated legacy. Elvis's beauty in youth matched Marilyn's. Think of him in radiant profile, as timeless as an ancient coin. His music endures partly because in his voice we hear confidence and longing, and twined opposites that speak to similar contradictions in ourselves. Strangely, or maybe not, rather than falling victim to our fragmented attention spans, Elvis has proved to be the perfect foil for them, surfing a million waves simultaneously. And every seemingly easy conclusion made about Elvis, the claim, for instance, that he stole from black artists, has a counterweight that clouds facile certainty. One unequivocal truth is that although he drew from all musical sources, including country and pop, he both loved and was deeply influenced by black musicians. It is also true that he made a great deal more money off black or black-influenced music than most black artists of his time. His 1956 mega-hit Hound Dog certainly netted a lot more dough for him than it did for Big Mama Thornton, who earned just $500 off her own hit 1952 version. The irony is that the song was written specifically for her by the white songwriting duo Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. But Elvis did not steal the song from Thornton. Cover versions are part of pop music's vernacular, and it is the songwriters who earn the big royalties anyway. Reportedly, Lieber and Stoller hated Elvis's Hound Dog, much preferring the rolling sensuality of Thornton's. And even if being white and male gave Elvis certain advantages over Thornton, especially in the world of music contracts, his white man status was not as huge an advantage as you might think. Precisely because he broke rules about how white men should look and sound and move, plenty of white Americans, especially parents, thought of him as a degenerate, a not-so-veiled indication of America's deep racist roots. Black music was not a thing any white person was supposed to aspire to, even if Elvis eventually reached unimaginable heights of popularity. He was an outlier in his time, a comet, the likes of which no one had ever seen. And like all great artists, he built on what came before him, on songs and sounds he loved and admired. As much as he yearned for fame, the music came first. He is part of the story of racial injustice in this country, but the whole of it is too large and unwieldy to be laid at his feet. Given the complexity of Elvis's legacy, you would think a Dazzlemeister like Luhrmann would be the worst filmmaker to take it on. Luhrmann's movies, even the great ones, like his 1996 Shakespeare via Tiger Beat romance Romeo plus Juliet, or The Great Gatsby from 2013, a fringed shimmy of decadence and loneliness, are loathed by many for what they see as the director's garishness, his adoration of spectacle, his penchant for headache-inducing, mincemeat and glitter editing. And Elvis is in some ways a mess, just like Elvis himself was a mess. Yet the movie's frenetic, prismatic quality may be the best way to deal with the messy whole of Elvis. At times, Elvis is barely a movie. The first hour or so is shredded and frenzied, as if Luhrmann were time-traveling through a holographic rendering of Elvis's life, dipping and darting through the significant events with little time to touch down, and Luhrmann's use of Colonel Tom Parker, Elvis's diabolically crooked manager, as a framing device, he is played with a weird accent by Tom Hanks, sometimes derails the film. It is as though building a case for Elvis's victimhood were the only means of earning our sympathy for this prodigiously gifted, haunted man. But the exuberance of Elvis, refracted in the doppelganger energy of its star, Austin Butler, elevates it to a realm above taste where only sensation matters. Butler conjures the guilelessness of Elvis's face, his soft yet chiseled cheekbones, the look in his eyes that say, "I'm up for anything, are you?" He and Luhrmann hop through the major events of Elvis's life, sometimes going for long stretches without taking a breath. Elvis is exhausting. It is also exhilarating, a crazy blur you cannot look away from. As a strict 100% factual biopic, Elvis is probably a failure. But as a biography of an idea, it's as much a triumph as you could hope for, a work of controlled and sustained mad love for an artist whose story is never ending. The cultural critic Grile Marcus once said of Elvis, "His voice gets to the heart of everything you want out of life. A balls-out hip shaker in a pink suit that appears to be made of liquid, and unmanageable fantasy in tight leather pants, a crooner pouring his silken soul into us like an offering from a Vegas stage. There's an Elvis for every one of us and for every part of us, a man who came from less than nowhere and spoke of all the things he wanted to be. If he fell short, well, so do we." From Time Off Television, a billionaire's starter wife starts over by Judy Berman. Maya Rudolph is the kind of star you would build a show around. A warm, charismatic performer who has jokingly described herself as a 2 3/4 threat. The SNL alum has pipes that can belt out Purple Rain and win Emmys for voicing Big Mouth's hormone monstrous Connie. She also has a gift for physical comedy. Who could forget her bridesmaid's character sinking into the street, face registering every phase of humiliation as the food poisoning hit? Yet it is still bafflingly rare to see Rudolph in leading roles. One notable exception was 2018's Forever, a philosophically ambitious afterlife dramedy that cast her and Fred Armisen as dead spouses working through unfinished business. Now Rudolph has re-teamed with its creators, Alan Yang and Matt Hubbard, on Loot, L-O-O-T, a comedy about the jilted wife of a multi-billionaire. Unfortunately, it's a much safer and more conventional show than its predecessor. When we meet Rudolph's Molly Wells, she is swanning around on her new mega yacht with her tech mogul husband, John Novak, Adam Scott in toxic nerd mode. That same day, she discovers he's cheating. "I have been by your side for 20 years, Molly screeches in front of a crowd at her own birthday party. "I had sex with you when you had your weird body before you fixed it with money." The divorce leaves her with $87 billion, and after a rebound tour that's more dance, drink, drugs than eat, pray, love, she's summoned to the offices of her foundation by its executive director, Sophia Salinas, Pose star, Michaela Jai Rodriguez. Sophia just wants her to stop embarrassing the charity in the media with her intoxicated shenanigans, but Molly sees a chance to redeem herself by throwing herself into the organization's work. By the end of the premiere, Loot has become an upbeat workplace sitcom in the mold of Parks and Recreation, where Yang got his start. The ensemble is strong. Fire Island breakout Joel Kim Booster as Molly's loyal, emotionally numb assistant pairs nicely with the hilarious Ron Funches as a gregarious cousin of Molly's who parlayed his connection into a job. A kind milquetoast, played by Nat Faxon, makes a fine love interest for Molly. The show struggles most at its attempts to set up a central tension between Molly's spoiled naivete and Sophia's stern pragmatism. The parts are cast well, although Rodriguez sometimes appeared stiff in pose, her uptight vibe contrasts well with Rudolph's easy charm. But both are underwritten in scripts that are thoughtlessly deem Sophia's prickliness as worthy of criticism as Molly's blithe profligacy. Not every show about the ultra-wealthy needs to be as biting as Succession, but Loot too often comes off as entirely toothless. A satire so clearly inspired by real people, Jeff Bezos and his philanthropist ex, Mackenzie Scott, should have something substantive to say about a world where they play outsized roles. Loot takes that risk too late in the season, without earning it through insight into who Molly was before she became Mrs. John Novak. Scott is a novelist. If Molly ever had talents or dreams or convictions, we don't find out about them. That the show still intermittently manages to amuse is a credit to Rudolph, and offers hope that Yang and Hubbard could write the mega yacht in subsequent seasons. Waiting for the green ship to come in, the world's maritime transport fleets are growing. That is a big climate problem, by Alejandro de la Garza. Container ships transport just about everything. The world wants more of all of it, so the ships are getting bigger, as are the shipping channels, port complexes, and loading cranes. All over the world, they are expanding and building more and more terminals to accommodate more and more vessels, says Captain Erdogan Mortaza, speaking on the bridge of his nearly 10 million cubic foot container ship, the Gerda Maersk. Outside the windscreens, thousands of containers painted in dull primary colors are stacked 9 levels high on the deck. Onshore, in an Elizabeth, New Jersey container terminal, many more of these steel boxes spread into the distance like disassembled pieces of a giant's playset. When it was built in 2009, the Gerda Maersk was one of the largest container ships in the world. It is nearly a quarter mile long, with a hold 7 stories deep. But even this monster has been dwarfed by the industry's expansion. It is able to carry only half the cargo of some recently launched ships. Mortaza says the growth is only accelerating. During this pandemic, people went crazy because they were closed inside their homes. So what do? You go online and start shopping, he says. All that stuff has to come through these boxes. Proponents of maritime shipping are fond of referring to growth in the sector as a gauge of global economic well-being. They also trumpet shipping's environmental bona fides, citing statistics showing ocean-going vessels are one of the most energy-efficient ways to move goods around the world. But though those ships may be less carbon-intensive than, say, cargo airplanes, they still account for almost 3% of global CO2 emissions, and it is unclear how that might change. Where sectors like automobiles and electricity grids are relatively straightforward to convert to renewable power, the constraints of physics mean there's currently no simple way to move millions of tons of cargo across the oceans without fossil fuels. And despite ships getting more energy efficient in recent decades, overall emissions continue to rise as the industry expands. Last year alone, the industry's CO2 emissions jumped nearly 5%. Mortaz's employer, the Danish shipping giant Maersk, says it is investing in a solution, replacing conventional fuels with so-called green methanol as part of a plan to reach net zero emissions by 2040 and hopefully begin turning the global shipping industry's emissions trajectory in the right direction. Today, facilities around the world produce about 100 million tons of methanol annually, almost all of which is derived from fossil fuels, and much of which is used as industrial feedstock for things like plastic production. Using fossil fuel-based methanol to power ships, as some pilot projects have done, is not much different climate-wise from simply burning the natural gas or coal it is made from. So instead, Maersk is trying to power its ships with green methanol. There are two versions Maersk and others in the industry are working with. The first is biomethanol, which entails extracting the molecule from biomass like crop waste. The second is electromethanol, or e-methanol, created by combining CO2 with hydrogen, produced from water using renewable electricity. These green forms of methanol still release CO2 when they are burned, but in both cases, it is the same CO2 that had already been sucked out of the atmosphere, either by plants or machines, when the methanol was produced. That means their overall contribution to a ship's carbon footprint is far lower than using new fossil fuels pulled up out of the ground. Between mid-2021 and early 2022, Maersk ordered 12 new cargo vessels able to run on methanol to be delivered from Hyundai Heavy Industries in Korea in 2024 and 2025. In a pinch, they can also run on conventional fuels. Soon after, Maersk signed deals to secure enough green methanol to start sailing them. The new vessels account for only about 2% of Maersk's global fleet, but it is a first step toward decarbonizing the world's second biggest shipping company, says Morten Bo Christiansen, who leads Maersk's climate efforts. This will mean continually replacing ships that age out of service with ones able to sail on methanol or other fossil fuel alternatives. It was really a chicken and egg type situation, Christiansen says. No one was building green vessels because there was no green fuel, but no one produced green fuel because there were no vessels to burn it. This for us has been an attempt to break that. Danish wind and solar company European Energy is one of the players slated to produce that fuel. It is constructing what is billed as the world's first large-scale e-methanol plant in Kosso, Denmark. Maersk will be buying half its output when production starts in the second half of 2023. The plan was the brainchild of Søren Knudsen Kier, a former engineering professor at Aalborg University, who's working with European Energy on the new facility. The goal is to help solve a crucial challenge in decarbonizing shipping: how to store large amounts of energy, transport it, and have it ready when you need it most, like in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, without using fossil fuels, which are very energy dense, meaning they take up relatively little space and weight compared with other possible sources of power. When it comes to storing green energy, batteries are often the most efficient approach, but they are too bulky for use in airplanes and ships. Hydrogen's another option. Producers use giant electrolyzers and renewable power to separate hydrogen from water. And then ships either burn that hydrogen directly or use fuel cells to release its stored energy. But, says Kerr, Hydrogen gas is hard to store and transport because it takes a lot of energy to compress it to a manageable volume. Around 2018, CARE started developing a pilot facility that would combine large amounts of hydrogen with carbon dioxide to form e-methanol, which can store energy in liquid instead of gaseous form, meaning it does not need to be transported in high-pressure tanks. A few years later, European Energy came on board to back a much larger version of the project. Maersk is not the only company that is eyeing methanol. CMA CGM, the world's third largest shipping container shipper, ordered 6 new methanol-powered container ships in June. And Swedish shipper Stena Bulk is building methanol-powered tankers with Swiss chemical company Proman. Go back even a year and a half ago, we'd go to a shipping conference and we'd get an opportunity to present on the last panel of the last day, says Greg Dolan, CEO of the Methanol Institute, an industry trade association. Now there's so much more interest in methanol, we are getting keynote slots. Despite the current craze, green methanol has a long-term handicap. Methanol is a carbon-based fuel. So to make it, we need a lot of carbon. Fossil fuels are a great place to find this stuff, but we're slowly cooking the earth as we keep pulling it up from underground and adding it to the climate system in the form of new carbon dioxide. The challenge is to find carbon that's already in circulation and will not tip the overall carbon balance any further. That would seem simple. Too much CO2 is our problem, after all. But pulling that CO2 from coal power plant smokestacks does not create a truly green process, since it would only delay that extra fossil fuel-sourced CO2 going into the air when ships burn the methanol that was made from the pollutant. You're going to use carbon one more time, but it's still going to end up in the atmosphere, says Alain Gappert, a research scientist studying methanol systems at the University of Southern California. Taking CO2 directly from the atmosphere might seem like a good idea, but such technology, usually referred to as direct air capture, is expensive and energy intensive, and some experts do not think it will ever be cost effective. Instead, the best current option is to find sources of biogenic carbon that comes from plants or animals, either biomass that can be transformed into biomethanol through chemical processes, or CO2 released from burning or fermenting plants or other organic material that can be combined with hydrogen to make e-methanol. European Energy's e-methanol project, for instance, relies on agricultural waste, like cow manure, for its supply of CO2. The problem is that there are not enough sustainable sources of biogenic CO2 to make more than a fraction of the methanol needed to decarbonize shipping. For example, even if Europe maxed out the use of its projected biomethane, one of the best sources of biogenic CO2, it would still account for only about a fifth of its estimated 2050 shipping needs, according to Fag Abasov, shipping program director at environmental think tank Transport and Environment. There's not enough cow shit, basically, he says. There are options beyond methanol that could be better for decarbonizing shipping in the long run. In some sense, hydrogen is a simpler solution, since you need it to make methanol anyway, but as CARE mentioned, it's hard to store it. Nevertheless, some experts believe the best approach would be to try to solve that storage problem. Rather than seek alternatives, others believe ammonia could be a good option. Like methanol, ammonia is already produced in large quantities for many industrial uses, like making fertilizer. Today, most of it's derived from fossil fuels in a process that releases large amounts of CO2. but it can also be produced from renewably generated hydrogen and solve the same energy storage problems as methanol, but without the e-fuel's carbon supply limitations. Ammonia, though, can be life-threatening to humans and marine life if it leaks. Methanol is toxic, too, but leaks would be far less hazardous. Maersk Christiansen, for one, fears some ports could ban ammonia because of its toxicity. The technology for ammonia engines is also further off than for methanol. Even if we solve all the safety and environmental challenges, it will be toward the end of the decade before we can get any ammonia out sailing, he says. For us, that is just too late. And this lengthy article is now being abridged. The mangrove moment, the miraculous trees suck up carbon and fortify coastlines, but will Pakistan's megacity do what it takes to be saved? By Aaron Baker, Karachi. This article will undoubtedly be abridged, but here we go. On a recent Tuesday morning, several dozen Pakistani school children barreled down a wooden walkway into a thicket of mangroves. They jostled for space at a small viewing platform and eagerly pointed out fish darting between the exposed tree roots. As the rising tide inched ever closer to the crabs and mudskippers resting on shore, the children's guide launched into a detailed explanation of the unique marine ecosystem fringing the coast and how it provided both a vital nursery for ocean fish and protection from tsunamis and storm surges. If mangroves are so important, wondered one child out loud, why are they in here and not out there? By in here, she meant the soaring glass atrium of Karachi's newly opened Magnificence Center, where the high-tech centerpiece is the living mangrove exhibit, complete with real trees, live fish, plastic crabs, and an accelerated tidal ebb and flow, maintained by underground water pumps. Out there is the crowded coastal megacity of Karachi, where all but a few of the mangrove forests that once defined this Indus Delta port town have been chopped down, paved over, and developed into ocean view high-rises, golf courses, and container ports. Mangrove forests are not just any old woodlands. They're one of the most powerful natural tools we have to simultaneously reduce climate change risks and protect ourselves from the impacts that are already here and those to come. It is especially true for warm coastal cities like Karachi. In what is left of Karachi's original mangrove swamps, one of the museum exhibit's designers is documenting, in forensic detail, the piecemeal destruction of a once pristine forest for his weekly social media dispatch. There are days out here when you cannot hear a single bird because the chainsaws are so loud, Tariq Kaisar murmurs into his iPhone with a David Attenborough cadence as he pans the camera over a clear-cut swath of stump-studded silt. Just a few weeks ago, he continues, the tree canopy was overhead, and the light filtered through as if you were in a cathedral. Now, he shakes his head mutely as he steers his small boat past a pile of cut branches, destined for the city's back-alley firewood markets and charcoal kilns. Pakistan's Indus River Delta is home to hundreds of thousands of acres of mangroves, and the country boasts one of the most successful mangrove reforestation projects in the world, but only a few remain in the economic capital of Karachi, where 16 million residents are corralled onto low-lying spits of land, many of which have been reclaimed from the sea. Kaiser, Q-A-I-S-E-R, an architect of some renown with thick gray hair, horn-rimmed glasses, and a late middle-aged paunch he attributes to COVID-enforced inactivity, has spent the past half decade fighting for the protection and expansion of a small patch of mangroves rooted at the tip of a tidal island directly facing some of Karachi's most valuable land. Developers envision landfilling Bundal Island, linking it to the mainland via a causeway, and turning it into prime real estate for an ever-expanding city. Kaiser sees the island as the terrestrial incarnation of Abdullah Shah Ghazi, the patron Sufi saint of Karachi, who protects the city from storms, disease, and hunger. I do not want to fight without the developers. I do not want to fight with the developers, Kaiser says, but I do want them to think about the future of this city. In a congested metropolis already plagued by the urban heat island effect, in which endless expanses of concrete buildings and paved roads amplify the already sweltering temperatures by several degrees, trees are a threatened resource. Mangroves, says Kaiser, are our air conditioning, our oxygen supply. If you just increase the mangrove cover, Karachi's next 30 years will be much better than if you build over them. That article was abridged because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.